The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hey there, Ben Rock.
Hey, Ilya Friedman, what's up with you?
Hey, it's time for another fine episode of the Cinematography Podcast.
I like that pause. For a second there, we could have been making cereal. People don't know.
Yeah, people would have no idea what this podcast was.
Hard left turn.
It could have gone any direction, but it's another episode of the Cinematography Podcast. Who is on the show today?
Jay Holbin, in an interview you conducted very recently, and I have not yet heard.
Yes, it was done in person, so that's kind of fun. So anyone who's actually watching this episode on YouTube will get to see a pretty good-looking image of both me and Jay in the same room.
And then at the end, I hear you wrestle.
There's a little hot oil wrestling, yeah, for sure. That definitely goes on, but you know, I don't want to have any spoilers.
I'm not saying who won.
It's our own version of an MMA cage match, really. That's what happens. So. Anyway, Ben, I'm very much looking forward to having Jay Holbin on the show. He is a dear friend. I've known him for a long time. And we're also going to give away a copy of his book. He's got a book called Shotcraft. We talk about Shotcraft in the interview,
nice,
which is really, really fantastic. And I praise it thoroughly during the interview, but I'm excited that we're giving a copy away. You just have to go to our Instagram, which is at the Cinepod, and the instructions will be there. And I'm pretty sure it's going to be like a, you know, follow and like or tag someone. It's going to be some sort of thing like that. But Jay's book is spectacular, and you should be spending money on it. And if you can get it for free by just going to our Instagram and doing a couple of steps, I mean, yeah, you should absolutely try.
Give us the taste. Like, what's the gist of the book? What's he talking about?
Well, you know, it's essentially, I don't want to give it all away, but it's a compilation of all of the different articles and stories he wrote for the Shotcraft section of American Cinematographer put together in this anthology. He delves into a couple of different things that are less technical and more about, you know, career-based. Like, we talk a lot about, like, reels, and that's a section of the book about, like, putting your best foot forward as a DP, like, with a great reel. So there's a lot of good stuff in here, but I would say that there's really a lot of, like, 101 basic stuff that I would say many DPs out there probably don't want to admit that they don't know. And Jay's a very technical guy, and he gets asked all the time how important the tech is, and we talk about that too. So I think that really, if you don't know who Jay Holbin is, shame on you. But also,
I've been reading his name in American Cinematographer for decades, it feels like.
Well, that's pretty accurate, actually. I think since at least, you know, the mid-2010s. So, but you know, if you don't know who he is, you know, not just shame on you. Well, congratulations. Now, through the magic of this podcast, you'll get to know who he is. And if you don't win the prize and win the book, you should definitely go out and get it. It's really, really good.
Awesome. Awesome. I can't wait to hear the interview. And now I want to read the book.
Yes.
Dang it.
I might know someone who's got one. So we'll see what we can do for you then.
All right. Yeah. Yeah. Hook me up.
All right.
And now, close focus.
So Ben, it is our close focus time of the show. What are we talking about? What's going on in the world of entertainment?
It would be hard to not talk about the Emmys, because the Emmys were, as we're recording, they were last night.
Are you kidding? It'd be so easy. We just don't talk about it. We just move straight into the interview.
I mean, what do they think they are? The Golden Globes?
Exactly. No, we should talk about them. We really should talk about them because, you know, it was a big night. Yeah. And there were some really, really good shows that got recognized, which is wonderful, because sometimes I have felt like I'm out of step with the average, you know, Emmy voter. But not this year. I really, like, certainly the stuff that took, like, the top prizes, I was really enthusiastic for it. I loved Shogun. We talked to Christopher Ross for Shogun. We gushed about it on the show. It took home 18 Emmy Awards,
wow,
which is a record.
Now, am I correct in saying too that it was the first one to win Best Dramatic Series that was not in English, primarily?
Oh, that's a good question.
I want to say I read that somewhere. That's
could be.
I'm making a plan about thinking about possibly strategizing a way to read that somewhere, to have had read that at some point.
The Bear took home 11 Emmys, which also we talked about in the show. Baby Reindeer took home 6. And in fact, Richard Gadd took home the most individual Emmys with 3 for Baby Reindeer.
It's not surprising, and I've only heard wonderful things about that show, and I started watching it, and I could tell. It's weird because you think, I watch all these horror movies, I should have no problem with it. But for some reason, that show I could tell was just going to stress me out so much. And I was not in a place to be that stressed out. It looked very stressful.
There's some cringe and some anxiety.
The Bear is like that too, by the way. Like, I love The Bear, but I have a hard time getting through it because I used to work in restaurants, and it's too real. It's too goddamn real.
And, you know, Jim Henson, Idea Man, took home 5 Emmys as well. So
deservedly so.
Deservedly so. Yeah, really, really great. Hacks took home 3, including Best Comedy Series, which, of course, Adam Brecker, friend of the show, you know, damn, that's a great show. Yeah, congratulations to them.
There were so many people on my Facebook feed who were angry because The Bear had the buzz that it was going to win Best Comedy. And they're like, The Bear's a great show, but it's not a comedy, and things like Curb Your Enthusiasm and whatever. And then, like, you could almost on Facebook, you could almost see everybody exhale the second Hacks won.
Yeah.
Great show.
Well, the Hacks is also a comedy.
So. No, that's what I'm saying. I know. Wasn't The Bear. I'm not down on The Bear, but I will say that it's a little odd that that's the category it landed in. And I think, is it because of the length of the show or?
It is a dark comedy, but it's dark. It is dark, dark. It is not like, you know, I would say there's probably a few more jokes in Baby Reindeer, and that's dark too. So, you know, it's a certain type of cringy, anxiety-inducing humor, which, you know.
I have to say that having seen The Bear and appreciated it, and I think it's a masterpiece, I wouldn't call it a comedy. That's just me.
Yeah.
It's not a comedy. I'm not going to say I never laughed, but, you know, like I might have gotten just as many chuckles watching, you know, the movie The Road. I mean, like it's not a chuckle fest. It's not a comedy. Like Hacks is a comedy. Curb obviously is a big comedy. The Bear, if you were going to call Breaking Bad a comedy, like no, not a comedy.
Welcome to Wrexham picked up a couple of Emmys. Only Murders in the Building picked up 3 Emmys.
Genius show. One of the best.
Last Week Tonight with John Oliver and The Daily Show both picked up 2. So, you know, there was a lot of stuff. You know, actually an anime called Blue Eye Samurai, which I haven't seen but has been recommended to me, that picked up 4. So, you know, it's, yeah. It's
Can I say, like, a hole in my viewing is I need to get more into anime. It feels too big to just start watching stuff. But there, and like Miyazaki wouldn't be considered anime, I don't think, right?
It totally would. Absolutely.
Would it? Because to me, it's just like, I mean, I guess like a Disney movie is considered animation, but like I don't know. I think Miyazaki is like the classiest kind of animation that there is.
I think really anime comes down to it's an abbreviation specifically for Japanese animation is really what it is. So it's talking to the whole.
But there's definitely a style that you think of when you think of anime. Like there are anime tropes.
Sure. I guess specifically in series, but in the movies, maybe less so, but there's a lot of that similar sorts of style for sure. Anyway, regardless, Ben, anything else in the Emmys that we really need to touch upon?
Not that I know of, because we already passed the cinematography stuff. So, yeah, I mean, like, not the stuff you and I usually talk about anyway.
Ben, we could yak on about the Emmys for a while here, but I think we should get to the interview with Jay Holbin.
Here we go.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
Jay Holbin, welcome to the Cinematography Podcast.
I am so happy to be here.
I am so happy that you are here too. This is something that we have talked about for so long, like longer than almost anyone. I think it's been at least 5 years. It's been years. So there was a pandemic in the middle, but yeah, I'm glad that we are here. We are
face to face, sitting in the same room, able to chat with each other. I'm really glad to have you on the show.
Me too. I'm very happy to be here, and it has been a hell of a long time coming. I try to be as elusive as possible. Just, you know, it adds to the mystique, really.
It's mission accomplished. Yeah, thank you. So, Jay, in addition to all the incredible things that you do, I know that you're a director and a producer, and you do a ton of work with the ASC, and that's how really, you know, we got to know each other, is because you are a grand poobah for the technical committees, which I know there's a fancy acronym now, but I still call them tech committees because I've been doing this since like 2006 or something like that. But like, please tell everyone about what you do with the technical committees. What is that title?
Yes, I am the co-chair of the American Society of Cinematographers Motion Imaging Technology Council.
Thank you. It just rolls off the tongue. You
Where it gets worse is the American Society of Cinematographers Motion Imaging Technology Council's Virtual Production Joint Task Force on the Virtual Production Standard Evaluation Material 3.0 Virtual Production Project. I said virtual production too many times in there. But yeah.
That's
all kind of stupid.
It's something. It's a small paragraph underneath your name, which is really great. Jay, you're also an author. You've written several books now. And in fact, one of the things I really want to talk to you about today is your new book, Shotcraft. Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken, it is taken from a large part from the pages of the American Cinematographer magazine. Tell our viewers, listeners, a little bit about your new book.
Great. Yes, it is entirely a compilation of my Shotcraft column for American Cinematographer, which started in 2017. And it's making no attempt to make a long story short. I've been writing for the magazine for almost 28 years now. And at some point in the early 2000s, I had pitched the idea of doing an educational column with the publication, and was pretty succinctly turned down.
Oh.
You know, hey kid, you're adorable, but you ain't qualified.
Wow. Okay.
Which was sobering at the time, like, are you kidding? and it came to realize, yeah, well, okay, well, they're right. I was young in my career, and so it kind of took a while to establish myself and put a couple of books out and do a lot of other teaching, you know, teaching for Wilmer Zsigmond School and amassing a couple other columns that I was writing. And then finally in 2017, Stephen Pizzello and John Whitmer came to me and said they want to start an educational column and want me to run it. And I was like, yes, finally. Yes, I've been wanting to do this for so many years. So just kind of dove into it.
Right on. Now, maybe I have it mistaken. Maybe because it was it also short takes? John wrote a column that sort of at the beginning of the magazine too. Was that, I, for some reason in my brain, it was Shotcraft, but no, is it Short Takes?
Yes.
Short Takes, okay.
So that's still a department in the magazine, and that's really on commercials and music videos and short films, yeah.
Gotcha. So, you know, for our audience, who is this book for? What's this book about? I know it's a compilation, but what sort of stuff are you putting inside of it?
So my initial audience for Shotcraft was the aspiring cinematographer. You know, it's myself and so many of my peers, we came up learning from American Cinematographer. It was the first thing that I ever went to as a kid because it was the first thing that had real information, you know, like real hardcore behind the scenes information compared to Starlog magazine or Premiere magazine or Fangoria or whatever else.
Entertainment Weekly.
Oh yeah.
Whatever it might have been.
Us magazine. Yeah.
The stuff that was supposedly about entertainment, but they were not really about the nuts and bolts, the craft of entertainment.
So I aimed it at them, at the aspiring cinematographers who needed to learn the real fundamental basics. And quite wonderfully, I started getting veteran cinematographers admiring and being real big fans of what I was writing, whether they were learning from it or it was a refresher and another way to look at it. So that started skewing the way that I was writing in not being like, okay, this has to be a 101, it has to be real basics, into just delving deeper into subjects that we don't normally delve into, like polarizers. What's the history of polarizers? How does it work scientifically? Why does it not work on certain metals? And really get into the nitty gritty of all of that. And again, getting more ASC members are like, oh my God, I never knew that. So the answer to your question is, it's for anybody involved in the cinematography trade, really, to get a refresher of some basics and get a lot deeper into others.
Yeah. You know, I'm playing dumb right now because, of course, I read the book and I love it. It's really good. So here's the part where, like, you know, I flatter you immensely. I feel like this book is required reading for anyone who's starting out. I feel like it is absolutely the best foot forward that anyone, and I do mean anyone who's starting off in the camera crafts, could learn, because there's tons of misinformation on the internet, there's tons of misinformation on YouTube, and there's a lot of misinformation that's even, you know, spoken word of mouth between people. But the whole idea of mentorship and the idea of, like, the real truths, your book is filled with those truths. Your book is filled with the type of, like, hard lessons that you only really get, I feel like, if you didn't get it from these pages, from, like, spending years under the tutelage of someone who has made a bunch of mistakes, someone who's learned the lessons to be able to pass that information to somebody else to say, don't do what I did, or don't make this mistake. Here, you should learn this. And in that regard, it's a massive success. And I really, really hope that anyone who's listening to this, who was like, I would like to, you know, have a really excellent foundation, I hope they go out and read the book. But I also have to say that I meet plenty of people just through the course of my daily life who they call themselves a DP, they call themselves a cinematographer, but I know that they don't know half the stuff that's inside that book. Mm. That book is invaluable for people who think they know it all, who think that they you know, have a pretty good mastery of their craft and the business and everything else. But you go into all of this different sort of minutia, and we'll talk about some of it in a second here, and I have a couple passages I'd like you to read, which particularly I thought were, you know, really, really spoke to me, and I think that our audience would enjoy. But what is the feedback that you've gotten so far from this book? What is it that people say to you who've read it?
Most people are really, really complimentary, and most people are incredibly supportive of the book and of the writing and of this particular column. Over the years, I have somewhat refined the ability of taking incredibly complex subjects and breaking them down into a sort of simple real-world language. So it's something that I'm very proud of and that I put forth into each of these columns that I write. So most people have been, if they're not liking it, they're quiet to me. Right?
They're keeping it to themselves. Yeah. All right,
but, you know, what you're saying means a lot to me, and I really, really appreciate that. I think the one thing that I hesitate to say, hey, this is, like, anybody entering should read this, is that it's a curated compilation of independent columns. So what I think it's missing is the real through line of A to Z, whereas this is just a lot of small snippets and topics to talk about.
Do I have to know the technical to be a good DP?
An extraordinary amount. It seems like I have that conversation every trade show with cinematographers and filmmakers who come up to me, and even the classes that I was teaching. And a lot of people point, and I think I do in the text, a lot of people point to somebody like Roger Deakins and say, well, you know, he's one of the most celebrated cinematographers of our time and is, you know, a self-professed non-technician. And my response to that is always, yes, but he learned the fundamentals. He knows them to a point now where he can let them go. Like, it's second nature. You cannot operate in this job without the technical foundation. It's the only thing that allows you the safety of understanding how you create something to recreate it again in the future. I get that question kind of constantly. And I think part of it is that people starting to come into this business are really frightened and really sort of, you know, look at the oppressive amount of technical data that's out there and think, I can never learn this. Oh my God, I can't get through all of this. There's no way that I could figure all this out. Well, there's fundamentals that are true, whether you're shooting film or digital or whatever, just in the basics of light and capturing that onto a motion medium, and understanding shaping of light that gives you the leg up. And then you can figure out codecs and all that stuff later if you want.
How do you define the job of filmmaker? What's your definition?
Oh, man. How do I define the job of filmmaker?
Description. Who's a filmmaker?
I think anybody who is a creative lead on motion entertainment. So that's a relatively wide definition of filmmaker. But, you know, in Hollywood, we live in a very, very specific box, right? You are a director of photography. You are an assistant director. You are a gaffer. And professionally, we want to live that way. But the rest of the world doesn't. You have somebody who is an editor, cinematographer, director, producer, sound mixer. And they have to do that as a means to an end to get things done. So I would say anybody who's really creating motion entertainment is a filmmaker. Or documentary, too, not just entertainment.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I would say that's filmed entertainment. That's, you know, entertainment, even if it is nonfiction, or partially fiction, or a little bit fiction, or whatever.
Are we talking the Michael Moore school of documentary?
There's a few different there's a few different influences there of reality, which is not quite reality. But how important do you think that the terminology is in this industry? That, like, you know, having these correct, having the job descriptions of like filmmaker or cinematographer, because I find that today more than ever, these terms get thrown around a lot and they're not being used necessarily to describe what someone really does. So do you have a thought on how important is the vernacular? How important is how we define these things we talk about?
I don't know. You're asking the wrong guy, because I am, you know, Mr. Absolutely everything is semantic and everything is has to be right.
I know, this is why I'm asking you. this is exactly why I'm asking you the question, because you and I think are of like mind of this. I think it's really important that you use the words that are most descriptive for what it is you're talking about. And I feel like job titles really, really get muddied about, especially these days with all of the different sort of predators and producers and directors and content creators. Like, I use the C word, you know, but you know, all these things are getting merged together. And if you look at like some of the job descriptions now and the different courses that say like take your filmmaking to the next level, but they're not really talking about filmmaking. They're not talking about entertainment so much as they are about like a regional commercial for, you know, whatever the thing might be, or a TikTok. I saw someone calling TikTok filmmaking the other day, and it's like, There is motion entertainment. There is something going on here, but it's not the repeatability. It's not the necessarily working from a master plan. I know that there are different levels of this, but I guess I just kind of want to get your take on making sense of the modern lexicon of what all this, you know, alphabet soup is, of all this stuff getting mushed together. You know, tell me about how you want to define these things.
Well, the funny aspect there is I also serve as the technical editor for American Cinematographer magazine. So on a monthly basis, it's literally my job to make sure that every term used is correct. So I tend to be very specific, like you're saying, in every aspect of it. But I think that also, like I said a little bit earlier, is a Hollywood mentality. Here in this town, and maybe New York as well, we have a very specific, there's a word that I'm looking for that I can't find, in being your job is very myopic. It's very singular. And hyphenates don't play very well in this town because we don't think that they're as professional as we are. So somebody who is, you know, in Boise, Idaho, who is directing and shooting and editing and color correcting and doing all of the jobs, I don't look down at them, but they're not in the same echelon as the Hollywood teams and productions.
Yeah, I don't think there's any shame in using the word that actually, or using the job title that defines what it is that you're doing. And I feel like when people really are selling the dream of whatever digital course or thing it is that they're offering, they love to throw around the words like filmmaker and cinematographer or director of photography, take your video business to the next level. It's like the terms become meaningless when you jumble them all together like this. So, I mean, I don't necessarily have a solution. It feels like in Hollywood in particular, in this little, and I'm assuming New York and Atlanta, there's some places where you cannot get away with that. You have to be very, very specific and very, very accurate. But how do you navigate the world of people who are not responding the same way or not doing the same thing? Is like, what do you have any advice you don't want to be that, you know, that nitpicker who's always correcting people, who's always trying to, like, you know, because I know you get to do that professionally at work, but how do you navigate just the world with that going on?
I think for the most part, I've kind of stepped away from being the world police.
Yeah, yeah.
Matthew Duclos, who I think you've...
Yeah, we're good friends.
...had on before, or I know that you know Matthew, of course. We joked for quite a while that we were sort of the lens police.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Going out and, you know, correcting the world in all of their... And I've backed off a lot on that as far as, like, there are certain publications in certain areas where we have to get it right. For American Cinematographer, you know, it's basically the magazine of record for cinematography. So it has to be right there. If somebody is, you know, wanting to call themselves a cinematographer and they're shooting TikToks on their iPhone, I would probably roll my eyes at that. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't necessarily jump out there and say, no, that's not what you are. You know, Jim Cameron is kind of famous for saying, you want to be a director, then pick up a camera, make something, now you're a director.
Yeah.
And I kind of like the openness of that. What I don't necessarily like is somebody who tries to come up and says, oh, I'm a cinematographer, and looking for, you know, work, and then they cannot actually do that job, realizing it's not just picking up a camera and shooting, but it's management of people. It's the politics of producers to crew. It's time management. It's knowing how to light and knowing how to expose and knowing the tools. There's so much more that's involved in that title than just picking up a camera. That's where I would have issue and be like, no, you're not a cinematographer. Come back after you've read my book.
Yeah, absolutely. No, really, I think that it should be required reading for a lot of people. In fact, I would like you to actually read this passage I've highlighted here.
Oh, boy.
And it's a long one, but it's a really good one. And I think that... I've just got three of them that I've picked from the book, but I thought this one was really great. If you could if you could read it for us, I think that'd be awesome.
You cannot have the technical skills alone and become a master cinematographer. You must possess the artistic and creative abilities to execute the director and your vision. Having a PhD level knowledge of Rembrandt and his technical esoterica won't make you a master painter. You could know the exact formulas of pigments and oils he mixed to create all of his paint colors. You could know the texture and size of each brush and the thread count of the canvases. You could know the wrist movements and the pressure of each brush stroke. You might even be capable of recreating a reasonable facsimile of one of his paintings. But without artistic ability, you'll never be able to paint an original Rembrandt quality painting on your own. Technical knowledge is not enough. Artistic talent is not enough. A cinematographer must possess both.
I think that is great and so incredibly succinct. Yeah, okay. Why don't you hold on to that? Because I got one more.
Oh, okay. No pressure.
Yeah, no pressure. I think that's wonderful. It's so succinct. And I think it really gets to the heart about what it is to work in the camera crafts as a DP, as the person who's responsible for the image, the final image, as the person who's putting it all together. Tell me a little bit about writing that. Tell me, like, you know, I know that this is, you know, your personal experience and that your life goes into it, but do you meet people who have mastered one and not the other, or mastered another part and not another? What's the, you know, tell me about the cinematographers that you interact with and make you write something like that.
I'm going to try not to get myself in trouble with
this.
Yeah,
don't get yourself in trouble. Yeah.
I run into it on a constant basis, especially with the magazine, that even sort of celebrated, golden statue winning cinematographers will sometimes not have a complete technical grasp of what they're doing. And a really common example that I'm running into time and time again is when we get into larger format cameras.
Sure.
And there was one particular cinematographer last year, I think, who, you know, was saying at the top of the story that they chose a larger format camera because it was absolutely perfect for the production. It had the right look. It gave them the right sort of epic feel. And then they went on to say how difficult it was, and they had to fight against shallow depth of field the entire production, and they were shooting at much deeper stops than they ever intended to. Hmm. And I wanted to throw my computer across the room when I read that, because it, what it meant is that they fundamentally didn't understand the technical tool that they chose to do the job. And they were fighting against the major benefit of that tool, which is shallow depth of field.
Yeah.
Right. So not understanding that aspect, suddenly they're in a constant battle with themselves because they've made the wrong decision.
You know, likewise, I run into people in this camera shop who come in who tell me they're going to do this documentary that's very run and gun, and they want to shoot on a giant, giant imaging, you know, medium format Fuji camera, which I go, you know, documentary, you tend to like not have a camera assistant with you, right? You're trying to like, you know, have as much depth of field as possible because you want things to be in focus. You're making your life so much harder than by fighting against the inherent nature of what it is. Yeah. And, I would say that level of misunderstanding, it's possible to achieve the highest heights or no heights without having this information. And so I think it's a heck of a lot easier though to get to where you want to go if you do have it. Yeah. And I think that like ShotCraft is a perfect example of a way that, let me tell you, all the 101 stuff and even the 201 stuff, you can cross this off. Like if you understand this book, you understand the things that are out there. Was that really, I mean, I know the goal is to educate, but I mean, were you trying to create a thing that could be that fundamental level that film students or universities could say, hey, start with this. This is where you should be.
I would love to say, yeah, that was the plan from the beginning. But unfortunately, it's such a kind of mishmash every month of what the column might be. Mm-hmm. You know, when we started, John Whitmer and Andrew Fish and I would sit down, we'd have a lunch, and we'd sort of plan out the next 6 months of columns. And in the very beginning, I wanted to have a plan, like, no, it's going to go, I'm going to start the fundamental here. You know, we can start talking about film emulsion and then exposure, and then we'll get into lab work and we'll build, and ain't no fucking way that's going to work. So because every month is a little different and it's a mishmash, I never thought beyond the idea that if I wrote enough of these columns, I could put them into a book. It's sort of a every month battling for my life kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
The very first book that I wrote, A Shot in the Dark, the first half of that book is a fundamental introduction to cinematography, which is much more of a by the numbers, and more complete to me. And the Cine Lens Manual obviously is a everything, including the kitchen sink version of trying to be complete from A to Z. And we wrote it very, very carefully to build on itself from page one to page 800. So I never really thought, you know, this will be the ultimate thing for students. I'm very proud that they do pick it up and that that does seem to be a thing. And in that, I'm very happy for that. But it was never really planned on that. It was, okay, let's collect these pieces and see if anybody has any use for them.
Well, they definitely do. I'd like to invite you to read passage two now, actually.
On any given day, the responsibility of the cinematographer is to problem solve a creative need for the director. If you don't understand the tools and the techniques available, how can you suggest a solution to a creative problem? Say the director wants a shot of the antidote vial looming in the foreground and our hero, their life ebbing away, desperately reaching for the background. Do we achieve this with an inclining prism, a periscope lens, a macro, an extension tube, a split diopter? Do you need the art department to make an oversized prop? How much lighting do you need to make sure both vial and hero are in focus? How much time will this take? What tools will need to be ordered? What tools can you use with the budget, crew, and other available resources? The answers to these questions require technical knowledge and experience. Knowledge is power.
I think that that encapsulates so much of what a DP does, so much of what they do, you know, day in and day out. Can you just, you know, look, I don't think there's much to expand upon what you just wrote there, because I think it's incredibly succinct. And but that is constantly the battle. You have a limited amount of resources. You have a limited amount of time. And do you understand how to employ your resources and time to get to the desired result? Yeah. And all of your skill is what allows you to be able to do that. I think that I have not seen that written elsewhere in such a concise manner in any of the books that I've read. So I think that that's very astute. And it's the only way you get to that knowledge is that you've done the job a long time and you've been around all the people who are doing that job the long time. Because let me tell you, those are the conversations that I think that really, really happen when you have people of a high level and they get together. They tell stories about exactly what you just described. Is there an example of a story, maybe from yourself or from someone else, where it's exactly that, where it's solution and resources and time, and how do you deploy those things?
Well, it's the first one that comes to my mind is I remember the first time for me encountering an impossible shot. So I was working with a first-time director who was a video game designer. And he had storyboarded this entire film quite beautifully, you know, from an artistic perspective. And he had this particular shot that he had drawn about the character coming to a phone. And when we got to that shot, I was like, this is not possible. We can't achieve this in real world physics. So the only way that we can do is to get other tools to cheat it. We can get a larger than life phone and shoot in that with that in the foreground. Or we can get some other lenses that are allowing me to get macro focus, and I'm gonna have to light the hell out of this to get super depth of field. You know, very similar to what was described hypothetically in the book there.
Yeah, you know that phone? That phone that you described there? I'm pretty sure they did that in Top Secret, and they played it for comedic effect.
They did, yeah. Actually, yes, that is the film where they did, yes, for sure. But it was a total like sobering moment of, I can't achieve this with what we have.
Yeah.
And if we really had talked about this and looked at this, you know, a little bit earlier, then I could have said, we're not going to be able to do that without, let me get a split field diopter. Let me get something to allow us to make this happen. And it also goes into play that experience and knowledge of the tools allows you to offer those solutions. Right. If I didn't know what a split field diopter was, then I could never suggest that tool. I would know, well, I can get minimum focus of 2.5 feet on this lens and this phone is going to be out of focus. I don't know what else to do. So you have to, that's where it gets into the technical aspect. The more that you know what's available and what's out there. And I'm a constant fan of giving the advice to people that in their downtime, go test and learn, you know, show up to Hot Rod and try out some new gear that you've never played with before to continually advance your knowledge base and the tool set that you have available. I don't know if that answered your question.
No, you 100% did. I wanted an example, and you gave me the example of the impossible shot, which I think that at various points, certainly in the lower budget realm, people are encountered all the time with the impossible shot, the impossible setup, the impossible whatever it is. And you have to figure out the compromise. You have to figure out how to make it work. And if you can't do that, you're stuck. There's nowhere to go. I'd like to invite you to read the last passage. And I believe that it all fit on that one page, so you won't need another page now.
Okay. Yeah. This is another big gripe of mine. Yeah, here we go. Slow motion does not equal great cinematography. Unless your specialty is high-speed photography, a reel of slow-mo shots is an immediate eye roller for the experienced director-producer. It's likely to be immediately tossed into the bin. Cool skateboarding shots do not equal great cinematography. Unless your specialty is sports photography, GoPro shots with cool action are not enough to make a cinematography reel. Drone shots are cool. But unless your specialty is drone photography, they are not enough to make a cinematography reel. A series of natural light, daylight scenes can be beautiful, but they're not enough to make a cinematography reel, unless, sense a motif here, that's your specialty. I do a lot of talking about reels.
Yeah, and I really appreciate that you added reels into this. And I know it came from the column, and I know that that's why it makes the book, but that's not a thing that is typically also talked about in other filmmaking books or about being, you know, about lighting or being a director of photography. This is like a business aspect. This is like, you know, how you find work, how you represent yourself. That reel is really important. And yes, there are people out there who put something on Instagram and get a job, but for people who work in Hollywood, for people who work in scripted productions, for people who work in, you know, major productions where there's hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars riding on everything that they do, the way that they got there most likely was because they had a really kick-ass reel. They had a reel that made people went, it made them gasp. They made them go, oh. Tell me from your perspective the importance of a good reel.
So I have a couple of different points of view here because I also work as a producer mm-hmm. and as a director. So I have a chance to be the person on the other side who is hiring. Mm-hmm. And I run a panel every year at CineGear called Got Agent, mm-hmm. where I sit up with a number of agents on stage and we talk about what it takes to find an agent, what it takes to, you know, what time in your career do you go after an agent? And we get into the subject of reels always. And I have this constant battle with them because the agents will sit up on stage and say, reels are not necessary anymore. Nobody wants to look at reels anymore. You know, have a website and have clips. And I will challenge them every time and say, great, totally get it. For your clients, a montage reel is not a thing anymore. You guys build custom montages and custom clips for your clients for every job. But when you're looking at a new client that's never been represented, what's the first thing you look at? And they go, oh, yeah, well, we'll look at a reel. If you don't have that, you know, representation behind you, that reel is everything. And I see so many bad reels that are, yeah, every shot is slow motion. And it's like that's not cinematography. You know, and every shot is a drone shot. Well, that's not cinematography. If I'm looking at you and considering you as a cinematographer, I need to know that you can cover a scene. I need to know that you can light. I need to know that you can compose. And I need to know that you have a diversity of style. And so I make the argument that reels are still incredibly important to me as a producer. Because if I'm going to look at 15 people for a job, I'm not going to take the time to look at 15 websites that have 40 three-minute clips on them. It drives me nuts. I want to see that two-minute reel. And in that, I'm going to know immediately, okay, this person I'll look at, this person's done, this person is a maybe, and then I can triage down and figure out who I want to go deeper in on. And then all of those tools are so important. Like, you want scenes. I want to see coverage, and I want to see how you are interpreting a scene along with the director. So all of that plays into it. But that montage reel, before you have representation, is critical.
I think so too. I think it speaks to if you have a personal style. I think it speaks to what it is that you think represents you and the type of work that you're doing. And I have occasionally had to hire people from reels, and you know, it sounds cliche and that no one wants to hire someone who hasn't done something already before. But when you do see that thing already on someone's reel and you go, I really like that. That really speaks to me. It makes it very easy to see that person in the role that you've got in mind. So if you've got a diverse reel, a reel that has a lot of different types of things that isn't just one thing, and each of those things is really, really good, I think you've got a better shot necessarily, I would say a better shot, even than that person who really just specializes in one thing. Because if you have the ability to do it all or to do a lot, how much more versatile and how much more capable are you as a person if you can show it off? I mean, what do you think?
I 100% agree with you. And I just had a conversation just a couple hours ago before I came here with the cinematographer, an Emmy award-winning cinematographer, who's struggling with work, as we all are right now. And I gave them the same advice that I've given to so many other people, that you have to put on your reel the material that you want to be shooting. So if you want to be shooting Game of Thrones, then you better damn well have a Game of Thrones looking sequence on your reel. And that's not an easy thing to come by.
Yeah.
But if you are able to partner with a director, and you're able to, you know, find somebody who's, you know, just starting to work with Epic Unreal Engine, and you can get a day on a virtual production wall and shoot that great castle moment, so you get three shots for your reel, that takes you quantum leaps towards getting it. Because like you said, somebody looks at it and sees it on your reel already and says, oh, this is great. Yeah, they can do this. If you want to be shooting, you know, docs, you got to have that doc on there. So it's all about, you know, being self-sufficient as you can be, and as much of a self-starter as you can be. Mm-hmm. And to put together people around you to help you create that spec commercial or that short. And it doesn't have to be a 20-minute short. You can literally make three shots and improve your reel. When I was building my cinematographer's reel, that's exactly what I was doing. I was literally doing it shot by shot. And Christopher Probst, who was my co-writer on the lens manual, he and I constantly, back in the pre-digital days, were calling each other up like, dude, I got a camera tonight. Okay, sweet. I got some film tonight. And we would be in one of our living rooms shooting a beer pour, you know, lit with table lamps that were tipped over and posters that were turned back to get the right bounce. And just to get that shot on a reel, because that helped to build what we were doing. So I really, really advocate that idea of get out and be self-sufficient and shoot the stuff that you want to be shooting, and it'll help you get there.
Yeah, I agree. How important is it for a DP to have a network of other DPs that they socialize with, trade work with, you know, get out there? I mean, there's lots of like popular business sayings, like your net worth is your network. How do you feel about your network when it comes to working in cinema?
I think it's really critical. We are social beasts, especially in this business. And, you know, I'm not a religious guy, and I really don't have a lot of patience for most organized religions. But one of the great benefits of a religion is the community around a central belief. So there are people who are like individuals who can join together on a day of worship or a day of celebration, and they have a communal place to come to. And that's kind of what a network of other professionals is that communal relationship of somebody else who understands your point of view, who's going through the same struggles that you're going through, or maybe have been through them before you have and can give you that advice. I think it's impossible to operate without it. It's not going to get you work as often as you hope. That you need the network of the people who can hire you, producers and directors. And most, you know, if you're a bunch of cinematographers sitting around, it's rare that one gives work to the other, except, hey, yeah, I can't take this job, so let me recommend Ilya for this job. But I think that it's critical to maintaining mental health and emotional health in a business where we're all prone to terrible, terrible lows and depression every time we're not working.
How important is a mentor to you?
This is a heavy question. I have always been a little bit bitter that I didn't have a mentor. I never had somebody who took me under their wing and said, hey, kid, I'm gonna pick you up and I'm going to carry you. Which is one of the reasons why I am kind of dedicated to mentoring individuals, because I never had that help. I want to be able to provide that help to somebody else. But the definition of mentor is very special to me. And to me, it's a lifelong commitment to an individual. So it's not just, hey, I'm going to give you advice, or you take a sit in on a lecture with me, or teach a couple classes, or a couple of emails back and forth. That's not mentorship to me. That's just everyday life. Mentorship is taking somebody literally under your wing, guiding them because they are at a lesser point in their career than you are. And I also take that into just life advice, right? Like my mentee buying a first car or something. Like, yeah, okay, let me...
It's a big deal.
Give you,
it's a huge step.
Exactly. Yeah. Let me give you my thoughts on that. And, you know, here's the pitfalls of insurance and the problems that you're going to face. And, you know, going to that first contract, like, they're asking this of me, is this okay? Well, let's look at this contract. Let's break this down and let's go through what they're asking and what you want and how to negotiate. So I look at all of that beyond just, yeah, this is where you put a soft light to create Rembrandt lighting. Mentorship is something that is very near and dear to my heart. So there's only a few people that I truly mentor. And then I also just spend as much time as I possibly can answering pretty much anybody's question who comes to me. And I often say whenever I do a lecture or something that I invite them to come back and contact me at any time. Usually Instagram is the way. Mm-hmm. For you know what we talked about for the day or anything else they encounter. And if I don't have the answer, I probably know somebody who does.
Yeah, that's something that that really strikes me about you is that I know you'd be very generous with your time and information. And I think that you have a sterling reputation. You may not know this, but people talk about you and they're like, you know, that guy, Jay Holbin, he's really a good guy. And boy, he's always really free with information. So like, you better watch out. You keep telling people how you're going to give everyone this information. You're going to have people reaching out to you to yeah.
You know,
but there's something fulfilling about that. You like to be in service. You like, look, you and I are more alike than you think, and or maybe than you know. But we do a lot of the same sort of stuff here. My whole company does it. I do it. But random questions on the internet, LinkedIn, Instagram is a thing. That's definitely a thing. And I gotta say that when you help someone, when someone says you really helped me, it really does, you know, it at least for me, makes me feel really good. And I have a feeling it's probably similar for you.
It's very fulfilling. Yeah. I have a new book that's coming out. I have a new book coming out Ooh. In October.
Oh, you're dropping it here? This is an exclusive.
Right.
Wow.
It's the first public discussion of it. It is the Shotcraft Companion.
Ooh, okay.
And it covers everything else that I've written for the magazine in 27 years. And every little tidbit that I stole from the top cinematographers in the world that I got to pick their brains. Mm-hmm. So Roger Deakins, Harris Savides, Janusz Kamiński, Greg Fraser. It's what I learned from them in writing these pieces. In the intro to that book, I talk about what was a huge inspiration for me, why I write and why I teach and why I mentor. And that many, many years ago, when I was just a little wee tyke before I moved to L.A., there was a trade show called Showbiz Expo.
Oh, sure.
And I came out to L.A. To be at Showbiz Expo, and I went to the ASC booth, and I met Alan Davio. Mm. And, you know, I just swooned, like, oh, my God, this is the man who shot E.T., Empire of the Sun, Color Purple. And I had a couple of questions that I asked him, and he very generously, you know, very openly answered the questions. And that opened a dialogue that we kept going for, I don't know, 30, 45 minutes. And at the end of that, he said, hey, I got to go catch this panel. Do you want to come with me? I was like, hell yeah, I do. Yeah, I'm going with you. And so I sat next to him for this whole panel that he watched. And then afterwards, we walked around and he continued to answer questions and would, you know, find something and say, hey, have you ever seen this before? Phenomenal.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day.
What an awesome afternoon. Hanging out with Alan Davio, and you kind of just like wandered in. You'd never met him before, but he wanted to keep chatting with you.
And it was life-changing, right? Yeah. I mean, it was amazing. And at the end of the day, I shook his hand and I said, Mr. Davio, I really don't know how I could ever thank you. And he said, you can't. and that's okay. He said, at some point in your career, there will be a chance when somebody younger comes up to you and give them your time.
Yeah. You can pay it forward.
And I really took that to heart. It's hard for me not to get kind of choked up talking about it, but that has become a fundamental philosophy of my career. To give that time to as many people as I possibly can, to the point of night sweats, really. You know, it, to the point of where I have to stop so that I can actually get some work done. I find it a responsibility to give back and to help.
You know, I think that is a really good place for us to leave it. And, you know, here, I'll tell you, I had planned to get into, like, umbras, penumbras, and quarter-wave retarders, and all these other, like, you know, which, I know you know all these things, but you know, they're slightly esoteric, even though I feel like they should be, like, fundamental knowledge to the world out there. But, no, I think what a beautiful spot to leave it on. I think that Jay, you know, I'm really glad to have you on the show, and we have to do this again. We're not going to wait 5 years. You got to come back when the new book comes out, and we'll talk about that. It'll be fun.
I would absolutely love to, and I appreciate it. It was a lot of fun. I actually forgot we were recording this for a few minutes there. So,
well, that's exactly the way it should be. Yeah. All right. Thanks, Jay.
Thank you.
All right. So I think this is a wonderful place to leave it. Where can people find you if they want to get more Jay Holbin in their life?
I have no unique usernames, so I'm Jay Holbin pretty much everywhere. Instagram is the platform that I use the most, and that's just my name, Jay Holbin. And jayholbin.com is my website. Through my website, you can get any of the books that I have available. But Instagram is really the place where I live the most and spend a stupid amount of time.
All right. Great. Well, Jay Holbin, thank you so much for being on the show.
Ilya, thank you. It's a real pleasure. I really enjoyed being here. It was a great conversation.
I thought so, too. That was great.
All right. So that was Jay Holbin. Jay, thank you so much for being on the show. Great to finally have you. I know we were only talking about it for like 5 years. It's got to be a record for, you know, the longest we've been talking about having someone on the show to finally then make it happen, which is great. So Ben, you'll never guess what time it is right now.
It is 9:56.
That's accurate, but it's also time to pay our bills. Oh, okay. We have to thank our fine sponsors over at Aerie.
Who's Bill, and why are we paying him so much?
Bill keeps us all keeps the lights on over here.
That's fair.
So we gotta you know make sure Bill is well compensated. Anyway, so we gotta thank our fine friends over at Aerie, maker of cameras, lenses, and of course, lighting. We should definitely mention their newest light, which is, surprise, sort of a reboot of an older light. You've probably heard of the Sky Panel. The Sky Panel is probably...
Maybe once or twice.
Maybe the best-selling light in the history of Aerie. They have... the most popular size was the S60, which is sort of this 2-foot by 1-foot size.
More popularly selling than those Aerie mix kits that were on every film set for like 40 straight years.
You're thinking of the SoftBank kits, but yes, I think that the S60 out has outsold those.
Wow. Because
sure. Okay. It's one particular light, and those kits actually were configurable with a lot of different lights.
And thank you for correcting me. It's how I learned. Go on.
Okay. So the S60 has been rebooted as the S60 Pro, and it's essentially an upgraded version of the S60. It uses the same LEDs, but it's brighter. It has a better serviceability interaction with a cloud connectivity, which I don't fully understand, but that is something they're really touting. It has to do with their acquisition of Clay Paky, which is they've got this cloud service built into some of their lights, and now they've brought that to the S60 Pro.
Wait, how? A cloud service?
Yes, it's called Cloud IO. And it says basically will enable more efficient workflows thanks to our digital twin. So the digital twin is like a virtual version of that light that you can plug into different apps and software to preview your lighting effects. So for someone who's doing theater lighting, like I know you do, I think that might be pretty helpful.
That's bonkers. I've never seen anyone use one of those in theater. And I just to be clear, I don't really do theater lighting. I do projection design, so I'm just using projectors.
Excuse me.
Yeah,
but
I have yet to see a sky panel. I'm sure that some like big theaters must be using them because they're too cool. I mean, they are. I have to say, the coolest light I've ever seen, and that's saying a lot.
Okay, so here's what actually Cloud.io says. It says, improve your fixtures maintenance with Cloud.io, the digital Internet of Things device engineered by Clay Packy, ideal for rental companies, studios, and lighting professionals. Cloud.io offers streamlined diagnostic, remote assistance, firmware updates, and much more. That's pretty cool. Sounds like you can log into it remotely, and you can tell, like, you know, what's going on with the light, and possibly make changes or updates and things like that. So until
hackers figure out how to get into your light and turn it into a death beam.
Yeah, I don't see that's happening. Okay, so the Sky Panel Pro's digital twin. It says the digital twin is an exact replica of the S60 Pro in Unreal Engine, offering significant benefits for all types of production from pre to post.
What? That's,
so you can have a digital replica of the S60 inside of Unreal Engine. So I am not an Unreal Engine guy, but I think for the
Unreal Engine, I don't know how to use Unreal Engine, but I understand how it works, and that's cool, I think. That's above my pay grade for sure, but it's very cool.
It's the exact same size and weight as the S60C, which is the predecessor. And it seems like the other big difference is that they've integrated now the power supply. You don't have to have a separate power supply for it. So pretty cool. So anyway, yeah, the new Sky Panel Pro. So of course, available at Hot Rod Cameras. If you're interested, if all the stuff that I just yakked on about here for the last few minutes sounds cool, hit us up at Hot Rod Cameras. We can definitely help you with that.
That's pretty awesome.
And now, short ends.
Yeah. So Ben, it is time for our short end time of the show. It's the time when we talk about our pet obsession of the week. What's your pet obsession? What are you all about?
I want to plug a Twitter account, an X, formerly Twitter, as everyone calls it now. I still call it Twitter. I'm hoping people are like, why are you still on Twitter? And I'm like, it's because I'm hoping the landlord sells the building to somebody else and they call it Twitter again. But it's a guy named Tom Vaughn, who is a screenwriter and a screenwriting teacher. And he's someone who in his Twitter feed happens to constantly dispense some of the best screenwriting advice I've ever seen. And his X account is at Story and Plot. He also has storyandplot.com. He's a screenwriter, and he also teaches screenwriting, I believe, in Houston. And he also has several online courses. I cannot endorse the courses, for I have not taken them, but I will say that he dispenses pretty awesome advice. I was working on an outline of a script, and I was kind of hung up in the second act, and my frequent writing partner and good friend Bob DeRosa recommended I listen to a Ben Blacker episode of his podcast, where he interviewed Tom Vaughn, who spent like an hour talking about the second act of a script and all the different things it can mean and all the different things you can do. And when I was done, I'm not saying I nailed it, but let's just say that I have a much better idea of where I'm going and the potential of that. He's someone who's I may be misusing the term structuralist, but he's someone who's very interested in structure, but interested in structure as a way to set your creativity free, not a way to be super formulaic. But I all the time, like literally daily, I'll see his Twitter feed, and he'll be dispensing some like wonderful, hard-won advice about screenwriting. And this is someone who's had many screenplays produced. He has been the primary writer on several. He has been the script doctor on several. He's been in the middle on several. And he's just a really good teacher. He's very clear. And like, so this is a tweet that he made on September the 9th. And I liked it so much that I screen capped it, and I keep referring to it. My pre-outline phase for my screenwriting in no particular order. 1, verify the making of a great logline. 2, define the story. 3, define the dramatic question. 4, generate at least 5 great scenes and 5 emotional moments. When I satisfy these, I'll start outlining in earnest. And it's like, isn't that just great frickin' advice? Like,
that is. That's super succinct and extremely clear. That's wonderful.
Yeah, and he has a weekly free newsletter you can subscribe to, which I have. But anyway, I just think he's awesome. And I know a lot of the people who listen to the show are generalists, not just obsessed with cinematography, but interested in general filmmaking. And I feel like it's always good when you find somebody. I know I've talked about the Script Notes podcast on here, but like when you find somebody who can just like really hone down and make something make perfect sense, and communicate how to get to the craft part of your craft faster. I just really dig it. So check it out if you're on Twitter, and if you're not, still go to storyandplot.com and maybe sign up for his newsletter.
I'll totally check it out. Sounds good.
How about yourself, Ilya? What are you all about this week?
You know, it was actually something that you recommended to me.
Oh shit!
Ages ago, and you said that you loved, and I was like, one of these days, I'm gonna have to like, you know, we talk about how
you finally watched John Dies at the End. Is that what you're telling me?
No, I didn't. It wasn't John Dies at the End, but that's on the list too. Oh, I mean, so the list is long of stuff that you've given me, but you recommended The Old Man.
Oh, so good!
I'd never seen The Old Man, and I like John Lithgow. I like Jeff Bridges and Alia Shawkat, who, of course, I've been going back. I mentioned it before. I'm going back and watching all of Arrested Development. She, of course, played Maybe, the character of Maybe in that. She is now grown up and an adult, and I know she's been in other things, but somehow I have avoided seeing her in anything since Arrested Development. So it's really fun to see like these all these great actors in this great piece all put together that's filled with drama and intrigue. And I'm only like probably episode 3 or 4 right now.
Oh, you've got some good stuff coming your way.
And I got so much to look forward to. And there's a whole other season.
Yeah, the new season started last week, right?
Yeah, something like that. There's been a lot of, like, let me tell you, you know, people talk about peak TV being over. It doesn't feel like it to me. Slow Horses is back. I'm really excited about that show. I've totally gotten to this new show that's on Hulu called How to Die Alone. That's really entertaining. So there's a bunch of good stuff, I feel like, right now here in the fall. And I don't know. The Old Man, if you were like me and you slept on The Old Man, you slept on Slow Horses, stop. It's time to go out and check out these shows. There's some really good stuff out there.
It's definitely good. And I still stay, go see John Dies at the End. But yeah, no, The Old Man is brilliant. And it's just great watching Lithgow. Have you gotten to the episode where they have the younger guy playing like young John Lithgow?
Yes.
That is the freakiest piece of young version of an actor casting since the guy who played young Ray Liotta in Goodfellas.
It's really good. Anyway, so Ben, that just about does it for this episode. Who do we have? Actually, wait. Before we thank people, where can people find you if they want to get more Ben Rock?
Oh, boy. And you should. You definitely should. Go to benrock.com and watch my reel. Read my bio. Watch my corporate reel. You can watch a bunch of corporate videos I've made. I got no shame about doing corporate work. It's good paying work.
Corporate pays the bills.
Man, yeah, I'm in the middle of editing like 3 corporate projects right now. So that's been like keeping me up late. Check that out. You can find me on Twitter. As I said, I'm at Neptune Salad. You can find me on, LinkedIn, basically all the social media apps except Snapchat and TikTok. How about yourself, Ilya? Where can people find you?
You can find me at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com in Burbank and this week in Portland, Oregon. So getting the shop.
Is it open?
To get nearly we're getting some of the final touches done this week, so I have sworn that this doors will be open before the end of this month, so before October 1 doors will be open. I just don't know which
when you get it ready. I'll pressure my friend Greg Hale, who lives in Portland, to go check it out. He was the producer on Blair Witch.
Yeah, you should have him come by. I've had a couple random people lately like send me messages like, Hot Red Cameras Portland, tell me more. So yeah.
I mean, what more is there to know?
it's a camera shop. It's in Portland. We have lights, we have, you know, AC GAC, we have a little bit of sound equipment. It's like, you know, it's a miniature version of Hot Rod Cameras Burbank, but you know, it's just as friendly and, you know, clean, well-lighted place to spend money. That's kind of what's going on. So all right, so Ben, who do we have to thank? Who made this show possible?
I mean, the show would never happen if it wasn't for Alana Cody. I mean, it would, in that like you and I were chugging along for a few years getting like 3 episodes out a year before Alana came and got us in shape and got us doing 1 episode a week. So we definitely have to thank her for everything. Did an interview this morning.
Thank you.
All because of her. We got to thank Michael Dispenza, who's our intrepid, hardworking editor. Hopefully we didn't make his life too hard tonight, but I had a couple of brain farts. Last but not least, we should thank Kay Zalatrakshi, who composed every slight little sliver, every morsel of music that you've heard on this podcast. Check him out at musicbykays.com. Hire him to compose a score for you, or all the other stuff he does. God damn it, does he do a lot of things.
He sure does.
Ilya, you take us out.
I'm going to hit cut.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.